Welcome to the Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin and The Weaponization of Everything. And Mark's next book actually comes out next month. It's called Putin's Wars, From Chechnya to Ukraine. Thanks very much for joining me today, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, great to have you on the show again. Now, the last time you were my guest was in August. Quite a lot has happened since then, both on the battlefield and, of course, in civilian areas of Ukraine that are far from the front lines, but have been pounded by Russian missiles, bombs, and shells with a sickening and terrible result. And also in terms of actions the Kremlin and Russia have taken, a lot has happened. Mostly, I guess, actions they've taken to adjust to the situation on the battlefield. We'll get to that second part a little later, but my first question has to do with the fact that today marks 8 months since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched this large-scale invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, two-thirds of a year. Now, I would say that until the morning of February 24th, or at least until a particularly grim and bellicose address that Putin delivered, I think it was 3 days earlier, many observers believed that Russia would not invade, or maybe it would be more accurate to say they couldn't quite believe that Russia would invade, despite the signals that increasingly pointed in that direction. That was certainly my feeling or view at the time. But my question, Mark, is, how does the way the war has gone over these 8 months differ from what you expected that terrible morning when it became clear that Russia had, in fact, begun this unprovoked invasion?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, because absolutely, I think for most of us, as it were, who are, you know, in the analytic community outside of those with access to intelligence materials, there was, as you say, a certain disbelief. And I'll hold my hands up. I mean, until about a week before, and certainly that particularly bizarre and horrific televised Security Council meeting, I had thought the odds were no more than 30 to 40% that Russia would actually invade, because precisely it didn't seem to make sense. Of course, what makes sense to us isn't necessarily what makes sense to Putin in his bubble. Of course, the other interesting paradox at that time was the very people on the whole who were the most bullish about the fact that Putin would invade also tended to be the most bullish in saying that essentially it would all be over in a couple of weeks. That although there will be mopping up pacification operations and so forth, that in those 2 weeks that the Russian military would spear its way through Ukraine. So, you know, in this respect, it's a suitable example of some of the perils of prediction. Broadly speaking, I mean, I think the things I would actually sort of highlight as being the 8 month surprises, and, you know, look, obviously one has to address the question of the extraordinary determination of the Ukrainians to defend their own homeland. Though in some ways that shouldn't come as a surprise. You know, even if one looks back to the Great Patriotic War, I mean, you know, there has been evidence enough of that. However, again, the striking thing is the degree to which still 8 months on, I would argue that the Ukrainians' real secret weapon has been Vladimir Putin himself. His continued determination to try and, for example, micromanage the war. His desperate effort to take what is, after all, a really major military undertaking. You know, although, fine, Ukraine is not as big as the Russian Federation, but nonetheless, you know, it has a population of more than 40 million. This is not something like a military deployment of your air power into Syria, or indeed a five-day war in Georgia. You know, this was always going to be a major military endeavor. And yet, from the very first, Putin interfered. Putin overlaid his own half-baked pseudo-historical notions of what Ukraine was onto any kind of attempt at rational military planning. And, I mean, by all accounts, for example, although there now seems to be a withdrawal from Kherson, you know, essentially, by all accounts, the Russian military have been wanting to actually do that for weeks, if not months, and Putin had blocked them. Now, Kherson is, frankly, I wouldn't quite say indefensible at the moment, but nonetheless, it is a dangerous place to try and hold on to, given that particularly Ukraine's now massive advantage in long-range fires. So in this context, again, even now, Putin continues to overrule the views of his professional soldiers. And it's interesting because what this means is that, and I would hate to sort of make any kind of suggestion to say that Putin should be more like Stalin, but the point is, Stalin, again, at the very beginning of the Soviet involvement in World War II, you know, again, had overlaid his own political assumptions, even though the military and his intelligence apparatus were sure the Germans were about to invade. However, Stalin very quickly learned that lesson, and he essentially confined himself to being the sort of broad political leader while his generals did the generaling. Now, Putin still hasn't learned that lesson. And obviously, Kiev has to hope that Putin continues not to learn that lesson. We'll have to see with in the new era of General Surovikin as overall field commander. So that's the first thing. Not that, you know, it's not surprising that Putin stuck his oar in right from the beginning. I think it is quite surprising how little he seems to be willing to learn. Second surprise, though, is in some ways a corollary of this. You know, it's obviously, if we look at how badly the Russian military has done, and the clear impact of incompetence and corruption and a lack of preparedness. Now, on one level, this is no surprise. We've known for a long time that the Russian military, like the Soviet military, had these whole array of different Achilles heels. But the interesting thing is this, look, the Russian military, the high command, they had a fairly decent idea too. Probably not of the full degree, but essentially that there was a problem, and that therefore they had constructed a whole series of bureaucratic responses which were intended precisely to try and minimize this, ranging from, you know, a careful structure for how you plan an operation and ensure it has the necessary logistical backup in advance, through to, you know, ways of essentially trying to get around the likely discipline problems. And again, because in part of Putin's own interference, but also I think it's clear to say a shocking lack of professionalism on part of the sort of the more senior commanders at work, these mechanisms have not really been applied or invoked. So, you know, all of these problems which could have been mitigated were not. And a military which, you know, are under Defense Minister Shoigu had reached a pitch where it could parade very prettily through Red Square and could put on limited shows of force with considerable apparent professionalism, such as Syria, such as 2014 Crimea, nonetheless essentially fell apart when actually put under a serious test. And then the final big surprise is, frankly, us, Western discipline and unity. Everyone was surprised by how quickly and effectively, for example, sanctions were applied and that they were much more extensive than anticipated. Indeed, almost in some cases, it actually became a problem because people were scrabbling around looking for more sanctions to apply. Now, yes, sanctions, of course, despite some people's ludicrous optimism that they would somehow bring the Russian people onto the streets and force Putin to change policy, you know, that's not how sanctions work. You know, but nonetheless, I think we have to acknowledge the degree to which the sanctions regime and then also the continued supply of weapons and at least, and I would suggest even more importantly, financial assistance to keep the Ukrainian economy afloat. You know, that has been a truly unexpected success story.
All right, thanks very much. So I guess to try to recap, not necessarily in that order, but big surprises are Western unity, Putin's inability to adjust to his mistakes, which I guess, or his misunderstandings, that the fact that, as you mentioned, I mean, I'm paraphrasing now, but from the beginning, he had envisioned something. He had envisioned essentially a Ukraine that did not exist, and thus was unable to effectively attack it, and still hasn't adjusted to that. And then also what you say should not have been surprising, which is the resolve of the Ukrainian people. So I'd like to, I mean, just to touch a little bit on the second of those points, I guess, the idea that so Putin apparently, you mentioned Syria and the five-day war in Georgia, and Putin did apparently, you know, think that this would be somewhat similar to those, like maybe a five-day war, maybe a special operation in any case that was limited in scope, even though, as you mentioned, Ukraine is a large country with more than 40 million people. And so I guess it seems like he still hasn't really adjusted to that. But for the second question, I'd like to ask more about the developments that have occurred in the last couple months, not over the whole 8 months since the invasion. Basically, I would say from the counteroffensive in which Russian forces took back parts of the Kharkiv region, a significant swath of territory in the Kharkiv region, and also parts of the Donetsk region, city of Lyman, or Liman, rather. And then the three things that Putin has done in just over a month. First, on September 21st, he announced what he called a partial military mobilization, but clearly a large one. The defense minister, Shoigu, said same day, I think, that it would be, they would seek to call up 300,000 people. And Putin later said they had called up something around 230,000, I believe, and that it wasn't done yet. Then on September 30th, he signed documents that Russia baselessly claims made Ukraine's Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson regions parts of Russia. And then on October 19th, Putin issued decrees purporting to impose martial law in these four regions, only parts of which are under Russian control. And also, I believe it was a separate decree introducing similar, if less drastic measures in a number of Russian regions. I think you referred to this as martial law light in some of the Russian regions. Mark, apologies, this is probably an overly broad question, but feel free to give it a narrower response. At this point, what do you see as the main potential effects of these moves in terms of the war in Ukraine and also the situation in Russia?
Well, broadly speaking, I think that they represent something of a tectonic shift in Putin's thinking. And look, any kind of attempt to suggest that one knows what Putin is thinking is, of course, a very sort of heroically stupid one. But nonetheless, I mean, I cannot help but feel that we're seeing the shift from him looking at ways of how he can win the war to him looking at ways in which he can ensure that he doesn't lose the war. And I think that is important, not least in terms of the sort of long-term prospects for any kind of peace in this ghastly conflict, which at the moment is, frankly, impossible to conceive of. I mean, the distance between where Ukraine is and where the Russians are, or rather where Kyiv is and where the Kremlin is just so great as to be unbridgeable. But if there is going to be any kind of a deal, even if it's a retrospective deal after Ukraine has reconquered territories, then in a way it relies on Putin having got his head around the idea that he's lost. Anyway, that's a very broad point. But I think what we do think is if one thinks of the annexations and the mobilization, which, to be honest, I think we ought to be considering as two faces of the same coin, they're very much intended, I think, as measures to hold the line. And I think that's where the Russians are at the moment. This sense that, look, for the moment, of course, they're not going to be able to make any further advances. But what they have to do in their own mind is to essentially stall the Ukrainians, rob them of the momentum that they have acquired, and hold them at least for long enough until the rains come and conditions become much, much less propitious for any kind of major advances. I mean, there's sometimes a bit of a misunderstanding of the Ukrainian winter in the sense that, oh, well, everything will then just stop until spring. That's not really the case. I mean, if anything, it's in almost three phases. The initial rains that precisely sort of churn up the sticky mud and close the skies and just generally make it hard to launch major operations. But then in high winter, quite likely that there will be the sort of temperatures which means that actually the ground freezes. And once again, there is a renewed opportunity until it begins to thaw. And once again, things close down. So, but anyway, for the moment, I think the Russians are hoping that they can hold the line. The annexations, they were the equivalent of Putin burning his own boats on the beach after they've landed. In other words, to try and make this case that, look, there is no way that we are going to be backing away any further and essentially push us and we will retaliate more gratuitously. And that may just simply be a rhetorical political move to try and deter not so much Kyiv, but I think the West. And I'll come on to that in a moment, the importance of his political struggle with the West. And mobilization, likewise, is an attempt, a very belated attempt. I mean, for this to have had real effect, it should have been done in the spring. But an attempt to address the key Russian weakness on the battlefield, which is just simply not enough soldiers. You know, a peacetime Russian military is facing a fully mobilized Ukraine. And that just simply is not working. And if one looks at, for example, the great gains that the Ukrainians made from their Kharkiv offensive, I mean, to a large extent, it's precisely because they were rolling into territory which the Russians had stripped of any decent troops and was being held just simply by a relatively small number of, to put it generously, second-rank units. So essentially, they need to have more warm bodies in the line. Even if they're not going to be particularly good soldiers, they are at least there. And the striking thing is, I mean, if one looks at the figures that Putin did give when he had his press conference after the Astana summit, in which he absolutely said that so far 222,000 of the projected 300,000 mobilized reservists had already been called to arms. But of those, a very small number, depending on, again, his figures are slightly ambiguous, but essentially, we are talking about fewer than 20,000 who are actually in the front line. In combat units that are actually engaged in combat operations. Most of these are being held back. So some troops to the front line to help replenish badly degraded units that are there. And just generally to just, block out the front line a bit, to, impose a few more dilemmas upon the Ukrainians who up to now have essentially had everything their own way. Meanwhile, most of these troops are going through training, not very extensive training, it has to be said, re-equipment to try and establish some kind of units of whatever poor quality they may be. So new units that actually come spring could be used either for defensive or small-scale offensive operations. Now again, is this the kind of force that is going to turn the tide of battle? No, not really. But what it is the kind of force that can essentially prevent the Ukrainians from imposing a military defeat on the Russians on the battlefield. And again, this is where I think this is the second key point is time. Time is clearly absolutely central to Putin's strategy at the moment. And he believes, and he may well be wrong, I suspect he is, but nonetheless, he believes that time is on his side. It's always been his view that basically Russia's strategic advantage is that it has greater will than the West. And fine, so the Ukrainians may well not be at all willing to back away. from the conflict. But over time, the West's unity and will, the West's preparedness to keep sending billions of pounds, dollars and euros into this conflict will decline, you know, especially after a hard winter. Possibly he has some hopes for the American midterms, you know, political turmoil in other countries. Of course, I couldn't possibly mention the United Kingdom. You know, for all these reasons, you know, I think he's hoping that actually after a certain point, the West will begin to falter. And the point is, if the West starts to question its continued support of Ukraine, particularly if it stops funding Ukraine at anything like the same level, then it'll be that much harder for the Ukrainians to actually continue the war. Now, as I said, I don't know if this is actually at all a war-winning strategy. I suspect it's not. I think ultimately this is a war that the Ukrainians are going to win. But in some ways, it's all Putin has got. I mean, I think he has to believe that it can work because his options otherwise are all unpalatable. You know, a serious and massive escalation is possible, but he also knows it will likewise dramatically escalate the West's campaign against him. Likewise, in theory, he could sort of try and back away from the war, claim victory with what he's got, make, you know, sue for peace, whatever. But in practice, of course, that's not something I think that he can possibly even envisage, not least because he fears, rightly or wrongly, that it would pose an existential political threat to him. So basically, this is all he's got, so he's going to go all in. Final point is in terms of the home front. Look, I think we have to acknowledge the degree to which actually Russia is, or the Russian system is coping. Despite all the problems, one way or the other, it is coping. I mean, yes, the economy is increasingly dysfunctional, but you know, Russians have been used to having a pretty dysfunctional economy. Ordinary Russians, a majority of them now, more than 60% of households have no savings. But still, people are scrimping and getting by and so forth. The government system is showing increasing signs of pressure, in particular, considering the degree to which it's designed to be almost deliberately unstable, with constant struggles between individuals, factions and institutions, which allows Putin to play divide and rule. Well, that obviously depends on Putin actually being present to resolve disputes and generally sort of act as a moderating influence. Well, at present, for whatever reason, whether he's just simply obsessed with the war, Putin isn't being present. So we're seeing increasing rivalries, not just on the big level of people like Kadyrov and Prigozhin criticizing Shoigu, but in some ways, even more importantly, on a slightly lower level. I mean, if you think of all these various mysterious deaths, there's no real suggestion that the Kremlin is behind them. It's more that these are examples of the way that murder is once again emerging as a business tactic. So generally, I think, you know, we're seeing a system which is undoubtedly under strain, but coping. And my view is, you know, it will continue to do so for some time. But what it lacks now is, or increasingly rather, it lacks resilience. It lacks the kind of reserves, whether it's money or legitimacy or managerial capacity, to cope with unexpected black swan type events of the sort which happen inevitably. And this is where I think martial law in part fits in. I mean, yes, martial law has a role in terms of you know, trying to consolidate the Kremlin's grip on its occupied territories. It has a role likewise in trying to ensure greater security in regions that border onto Ukraine. And, you know, it's clear that the Russians have a concern of Ukrainian, call it diversionary or terrorist operations on Russian soil. But it also is a way of trying to sort of mobilize mass support by making everyone feel that they're all part of it. But it is it is also part of the kind of response to this lack of resilience, to try and ensure that there is an infrastructure there for what we would really think of as, you know, nationwide potential martial law or similar sort of mobilization and militarization of all aspects of society if things go really badly. So again, I think all of this reflects the fact that whatever the bombastic rhetoric we're still hearing from Putin and other figures within the Kremlin, in practice, they're digging in directly and literally in the occupied territories. and digging in metaphorically in Russia as a whole.
All right, that's excellent points. Very interesting. I just I would have a lot of things to say, but I don't think I would be adding very much. I will just say, very interesting. You mentioned the kind of the lower level of the Kadyrov and Prigozhin attacks on Shoigu, obviously prominent, but you mentioned the lower level disputes and rivalries playing out with Putin kind of not present. I mean, and you said Murd. I was thinking, you know, has Putin kind of brought back the 90s, the decade that he loves to hate and I would say exaggerate about. So that's an interesting point you make. But I guess talking about where that might lead would be the subject of a whole different or another podcast. So I'll leave it at that. But we do have time to take some questions. So if anyone has any questions, please. Please go ahead and use one of the methods to ask a question. See if we have any that have come in so far. Just give it a few more moments. Again, you can hit the button in the Twitter space to request to speak, or you can send a direct message, DM, or pose the question as a reply to the tweet that's pinned here if you do have any questions. So if not, I'm going to ask actually Mark a question that I've been sort of wondering about, and you touched on this, Mark.
Hi, Martin, you can ask a question.
Okay, go ahead. Martin, do you want to ask a question? Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for this space. I wanted to just comment, ask a question. The United States 101st Airborne, the Screaming Eagles, were deployed to Romania, and I understand it's from what I read in one of the articles, it's not a training mission. It's basically preparedness for combat mission. I wanted to see what Mark and yourself had to say about that. Doesn't it dawn? I suppose not. It's maybe a naive question, but I'll ask it anyway. Doesn't it dawn on any of the more enlightened Russians that their leader is being the crimes being committed in Ukraine are being investigated by the International Criminal Court and other respected bodies that they are basically committing war crimes and genocide in Ukraine? Surely there must be, again, I sound naive even to myself, but there must be some sort of awareness amongst some of them. And the fact as well, sorry for blabbing on, but let me just finish this thought, that, you know, there's estimates range up to 60,000 Russian conscripts, troops who have been killed in Ukraine. Where is the outrage? Where is the protest movement? Are we not hearing about it? Could you comment on that? Thank you for this.
Sure, happy to. I mean, first of all, as regards the 101st Airborne, I mean, I think this is essentially very substantial and solid signalling more than anything else. You know, we are not seeing any kind of potential that the troops are going to cross the border into Ukraine or similar. And instead, I think it is very much it's a case that it's about A, demonstrating sort of support for border countries, but it's also, I think, an attempt to try and sort of show how important this whole conflict is to the United States, to NATO, to the West in general. At a time when there is considerable uncertainty as to whether or not Russia might be toying with the idea of some kind of escalation, we've got the current talks about Shoigu calling up various counterparts in the US, UK and elsewhere and saying that the Ukrainians are thinking of using a dirty bomb, in other words, a conventional explosive, but one sort of enhanced with all kinds of radioactive nastiness. I think this is an attempt to try and actually sort of say, look, calm things down. We are not going to sort of just let ourselves be intimidated out of continuing our support for Ukraine. So that's my thinking. On the wider issue, I would actually give one caution about the use of the word genocide. I mean, that has a very kind of technical meaning, and I'm wary of its too easy use. War crimes, I think there's no, in my opinion, real question about. Genocide, I would hesitate. It's a nasty, unpleasant war, to be sure. It's one that is being fought against the civilian population as well as against the military population. But genocide has a high bar. Anyway, but more broadly, I mean, look, I think, yes, of course, there are a lot of Russians, and I think probably a majority, even within the elite, who are deeply uncomfortable with what's going on. And it's not because they're worried because the International Criminal Court is investigating, but precisely because their impact on Russia, the fact that they are aware, to some degree at least, of what's going on in the actual war. Though, you know, we should remember that most people operate in an environment in which they're still cocooned by what is a pretty heavy censorship regime. But in terms of protests, I mean, look, we have seen, you know, tens of thousands of people who came out to protest at the start of the war and at other times, and they have been fiercely and ruthlessly repressed. I am seriously concerned about a sort of a prevailing view that we find in some quarters in the West that more or less says, well, somehow the Russians are all morally culpable because they're not coming out on the streets and protesting. That's something that is a lot easier to say when you are not in a situation where to do so means the not just likelihood, but the near certainty that you'll be arrested and that you may end up going to prison. You may end up getting sort of severely beaten by the riot police. You may be dragged into, as we've heard, some horrific stories of a back room in a police station and be raped. And what's more, the impact is not just for you, but for your family. You may well find that your kid doesn't get to the university it was intended, or that your spouse gets kicked out of their job or whatever as a result. You know, this is an authoritarian state that is really beginning to tip into the totalitarian. And we have to acknowledge that. So I think the thing is, for most people, they're constantly sort of having to juggle this cost-benefit analysis. What are the risks and the potential opportunities in going up against the regime compared with the risks and potential opportunities in just keeping your head down? And I think for most, exactly, that they find it hard to believe that they can actually meaningfully change things. And therefore, why take the risk for yourself and for your family? There is no real organization of any kind of opposition. And any attempts to do so will be cracked down. I mean, we saw how Navalny's movement was very quickly and very ruthlessly rolled up once they had decided to move against him. I mean, I don't think it means that all Russians are happy with what's going on. I just think that most Russians are frankly cowed. And it really will take that moment. And we've seen it happen elsewhere. If you think of just how quickly the Warsaw Pact states in 1989 collapsed, you know, these regimes can look very strong, tough and determined until they suddenly don't. But it will take that kind of, again, I think, some kind of systemic shock to kind of force people to actually quickly mobilize. And it may well be that it'll come initially from, you know, economic crisis, or maybe there will be a generalized collapse on the front line. But I think this is it. Just as the kind of the real challenge for the regime is its lack of resilience, part and parcel of that is the protest potential that builds up. And then, you know, who knows what will be the catalyst? I mean, again, I think in many ways for me, the interesting parallel is the Solidarity Trade Union in Poland that arose so quickly. You know, who beforehand would have thought that necessarily it'll be the Gdansk shipyards and a particular electrician by the name of Lech Wałęsa who would emerge as the symbols and the spearhead of opposition to, you know, what was after all, again, a tough and ruthless government. So, I mean, I think it's there in potentia, and it may well emerge. But at the moment, just the realities of a brutal police state are keeping it in potentia.
Okay, thanks very much, Mark. I'm going to try to ask two questions that have come in. Don't have a lot of time, but the first question is from Peter. If the Russians were to destroy the Kakhovka Dam to flood Kherson, what would have been the most likely reasons why the Russians took this action? Obviously, this is speculation, but, you know, this has been talked about a lot, and there are a lot of fears of it. So the question goes on, do you think this is something that is under serious consideration by Russian forces and the Kremlin?
Okay, I mean, the quick answer to that is, firstly, yes, I'm sure it's under serious consideration. It is an obvious potential option for a regime which, you know, has already demonstrated itself willing to do all kinds of ruthless things, in particular with attacking critical national infrastructure. Why would they do it? I mean, obviously, it would be in many ways a Pyrrhic victory because it also runs a risk of then denying Crimea water supplies. But I mean, I think it would be twofold. One is very specific, which is essentially to flood Kherson. Almost in that sense of, well, you know, if we can't have it, then we're going to make damn sure that you can't have a proper city either. You know, frankly, self-destructive act of spite and pique more than anything else. But I, you know, don't think we can rule that out. But the second one is again, in terms of signaling, the sense that we are willing to do gratuitously over the top things, even things that actually cost us because we're that crazy. And that has often been part of the shtick of the Putin regime. And again, it goes back to this whole business of the will gap with the West. This sense of, look, do you really want to keep fighting us when we're willing to do this kind of thing? So I think those would be the reasons, both kind of, you know, in terms of denying Ukrainians a city, but also in terms of trying to up the ante in their deterrent game.
Thanks, Mark. I feel like, I have to say, I think those two answers about the possible motives are quite accurate in my view. I feel like Putin has done a great deal out of spite and pique. So just to move on to this, maybe the last question. This one is from George, and from the Twitter Spaces link. The question is, what is the likelihood of Putin attending the G20? And that's the G20 summit later this year. In Southeast Asia, I'm afraid I've forgotten where exactly.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I don't know. I mean, there's several factors here. There's whether or not he's invited, which, you know, it looks likely that he will be. And it's a useful and sobering reminder of the fact that we sometimes think that the world is arrayed against Russia. But in fact, it is really the West that is arrayed against Russia. There are many other countries that, you know, may may not be fans of what Putin is doing, but don't want to get sucked into what they think of as essentially a West versus Russia conflict rather than anything else. It's also a question of whether or not Putin will be willing to travel. Because this it has risks, and I don't necessarily mean risks in the sense of someone will try and shoot down his plane or similar, but risks in the sense of that he may well find himself being snubbed by many world leaders. Obviously, so we've already seen rather embarrassing pictures of people like Erdogan and others keeping him waiting in front of the cameras and such like. Whether or not ultimately he will think that the gains to be made are sufficient to outweigh the risks, I'm really not sure. So much, frankly, will depend on what the situation is. I think if the G20 summit was next week, my suspicion is that he would not be going. So it really depends of whether or not he thinks he's on a roll. And in that context, I mean, I'm minded of the, I think it was 2015 UN General Assembly, where for once, Putin, who usually doesn't bother going to the UNGA, did, because this came right after the Syrian deployment. And it was at a time when the Americans under President Obama were trying diplomatically to isolate him. And that's why, it was one of the various reasons why the Russians went into Syria, to essentially inject themselves into an area that mattered to the United States and want to say, do you think you can isolate us? Think again. And then there was this sort of necessary meeting between Obama and Putin and an incredibly awkward photo opportunity, which in some ways the Russians were delighted about the awkwardness, because it emphasized his point that the American president didn't want to meet Putin, but Putin made him sit down and do it. So if Putin feels that there is gains to be, advantages, in other words, if he feels by that stage that he might be winning, or that, let's say, the Chinese have promised him some particular big show of support, which I think is highly unlikely, then he might go. But as I say, otherwise, I have a suspicion he wouldn't.
All right. Thanks very much for that as well, Mark. I'll just add, I've looked it up, and the summit is in November in Bali. So we'll see what happens, and there'll be a lot happening in between now and then. As you say, I think Putin has, often tries to use these use summits and other high level meetings, for the maximum possible kind of PR effect. But the question of whether he will feel he would be able to go if invited, remains to be seen. All right, we are running short on time, and let's wrap it up here. Mark, thanks very much for joining me. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, and thanks everyone for the questions. Once again, I've been speaking to Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin and the Weaponization of Everything. Mark has a new book called Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine that comes out next month. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out for the next edition of my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on November 4th. Thanks for listening.